Hey, it's Chris from Charity Digital. We think that digital ethics is an incredibly important subject that isn't being sufficiently aired in the charity sector. This podcast is part of our effort to ensure that the right discussions are held in public, and some of the opinions expressed might be viewed as controversial. We view our role at Charity Digital as facilitating the discussions, and to do this, we take an impartial position in our podcasts. The views expressed by the participants are their views and not those of Charity Digital. Enjoy the podcast.
Hi, it's Jonathan from Charity Digital, and welcome to this, the third in our series of podcasts on digital ethics. In the first two pods, we talked about what digital ethics are and data and platforms. In this third podcast, which was also recorded before the COVID-19 crisis, we talk about what practical steps charities can take to ensure that the digital services they provide are truly ethical. I think that this is incredibly timely, as with the rush to digitise services, with the onset of the COVID lockdown, some corners might have been cut. So it's great to stand back now and think more about important areas like safeguarding, privacy, inclusivity, and algorithm bias. For this pod, I'm joined again by Giselle Corey, Executive Director of Datakind UK, Chris Martin, CEO of The Mix, and James Malarkey, Head of Digital Engagement at the Royal College of General Practitioners. I hope you enjoy the pod. So welcome back to the third in our series on digital ethics. And in this session, we're going to focus a lot more on what are the real practical tips that charities can take on in order to make sure that in their development of digital services, they're being truly ethical. In our previous two podcasts, we explored what digital ethics actually are, so what they mean to our panelists. And then we started to dig down on some of the areas. So we dug into the areas of data and platforms. I'd like to move discussion on as well, because there's lots of other areas in digital ethics. I'd like to touch on safeguarding, because a lot of what we've talked a bit about, you know, what charities, which are organisations, do. We've talked a lot about the role of corporations here. We haven't actually talked much about person-to-person digital ethics as well. And if we're providing online services as charities where vulnerable groups of users are coming together online, there are clearly significant safeguarding concerns that need consideration. I'm particularly interested in your opinion on this, Chris.
So I think for me, one of the things when we look at how charities use digital is I think we've got to recognise that they have an incredible role in, we will do the things that other people will not. I mean, we mentioned a bit about sort of fundraising stuff, and actually we can be a bit ham-fisted when it comes to some of those sort of financial things. We need to do a bit better on that. But actually, one of the brilliant things about our sector is where we are looking deliberately to work with marginalised communities, with people in high levels of need, and actually that's really where we're applying all our digital stuff. I mean, we're going to do the interesting bits. And I mean, for me, looking at something like mental health, we see a lot of technology coming into the mental health field, and it's really quite commercially motivated. So they're kind of hyped up EAP programs. But in fact, you've got a lot of charitable organizations working in this community space around mental health, which is, we're doing the amazing work, the day-to-day management of people who have early onset of issues, people who are struggling to recover from things over a period of time. We're working with people who have very, very specific needs, and we're using all this amazing technology to kind of do that and structure that. And so I think around the safeguarding element, actually, we're probably breaking a lot of ground in how we do that, because in order to scale, we're using, because if we take just mental health as an example, we know the scale of that issue is far greater than any clinical intervention we're going to do by a significant degree. So we are forced into an area where we are going to look for technological solutions to try and get out to support all of those people across the board. And if we do that, we're going to need both sort of tech that interacts with people automatically, dynamically, driven by data and by AI, and we're also going to need peers. We're going to need to make those peer networks to leverage the best parts of community. So doing that safely is quite a trick, but I think we can do it. I think we have the principles of safeguarding. For me, whenever I speak to practitioners when we're trying to design a sort of new digital intervention, actually the first question is really, what do you do now in your practice? We've got our safeguarding down pretty tightly in terms of how, if somebody comes into your practice or your consultancy room or wherever it may be, or you go into the community and visit somebody else, you kind of know the things you're looking for around their family circumstances. How are they personally? What other agencies they're interacting with? What are the key signs that might indicate there's something more serious going on? You know how to do it as a face-to-face practitioner. So our challenge is really, how do we translate those really effectively into the digital world? So I think what we've always looked at is, so if you look at something like our online community, a lot of the principles which we apply there, although we do it digitally, it's very similar to the youth club. I mean, you're looking at how you identify and engage with young people, how you speak to people personally when they obviously have an issue. All of those things is done. It's just rendered in the digital world. Yeah. So we kind of use real world principles which we know work and try and apply them across to the digital world.
I think it's hard when your point, Chris, that we're breaking new ground, I think is true. And I think that the challenge in trying to break new ground in the world we're living in, which, James, as you say, is using a lot of platforms that perhaps we're not entirely comfortable with, is this like clash of incentives. And those platform, you know, YouTube's incentives are not the same as the Mixer, for example. So getting those two to align, or at least managing that misalignment, I think is very tricky. And on top of that, the fact that we are doing a role that, back to Chris's point, that these other platforms aren't seeking to do. I don't think Facebook is trying to have an individual relationship and safeguard individuals. That would be too much for it to have 9 billion users. But we are. So new ground. And to me, this goes to a bigger point around doing digital in the nonprofit sector, which is about... role model organizations. Who are we following? I hear a lot of organizations say, well, why can't we, Amazon can tell exactly what shoes I want to buy and make me buy another pair, why can't we use that kind of technology as a nonprofit? And actually we don't necessarily want to. We don't necessarily want to achieve the same thing those organizations are achieving, but more importantly, we don't necessarily want to use the same methods they're using. So I think talking about what we are doing in the as social change organizations using digital data and tech, and putting those best practice case studies out there so that we can guide others, we can provide a better a better imagination about what the future might hold for nonprofits than just all turning into Amazon and Facebook, but with a social purpose, which I think is an inherent clash, and we'd fail if they were our kind of they are our vision.
And I think we also have to be a bit careful, particularly in the safeguarding field, with just because we can do something, whether we mustn't lose the human element in it. So there's some great around sharing economy examples where you go, this would be a brilliant idea if a bunch of people could pick up older people who need to leave hospital. Yeah. So they can take them home, and that's a great and very easy to facilitate digitally.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a massive safeguarding risk with that, where you have vulnerable older people who may not be fully cognitively functional, or may not physically function, and just pairing them with random people, well-meaning people, 9 times out of 10 it's going to be brilliant. But actually, we've got to go. Actually, we need to look at the human interaction there. Would you allow it to happen in this sort of physical world? And if not, what would be the controls that you would place around it? Because we can replicate them, and actually, there are some bits in which technology can allow us to do that at a bit more scale. I mean, we can use AI, for example, to moderate online communities very effectively, and that allows us to have a sort of much broader range of coverage than we would normally have. As long as we can train the AI well, there's bits which we can scale, but we just have to keep our principles in place when we do it.
And something that... digital utopians, kind of people who think this is going to save us, might say, if they were present in this, probably none of us are those people, if they were present in this conversation, would say, at the moment, the way humans do things is often quite imperfect, actually. So if you look at decision making, we all carry our bias with us. So if we move that to machines, perhaps they can do it better. And I think a counter argument to that is that the machine, going back to the point I made earlier, the machines are using us as their teachers. So they're going to carry our bias and perpetuate that. And there's a big scale challenge there, because if I'm recruiting, for example, and I have a specific bias which ekes, however hard I try, ekes its way into the process. When you recruit, your bias is probably a bit different. And there might be some, we know there's overall trends about perception of men and women, for example. But there's at least that bit of diversity. If you scale up my bias, apply it to everyone, suddenly there's a whole subgroup of population which are never going to get in the door because of things I didn't even know were going on. So we have to, that when we transfer things from the physical and the individual and scale them up into the digital, I think we have to be very careful about what we're teaching. Mm-hmm. And there's a school of thought that says we have to make sure we're starting with, we're starting at a place where there is no bias and building up machine learning from there rather than using historic data to train machines. But that's not what we're doing at the moment in general, and it's also harder. So I think, I have to be mindful of the negative implications of scaling as well as the positive.
Yeah. I think that was a really great example of algorithm bias that came out a few years back when somebody was using it for hiring. I think they were using it for hiring tech people, weren't they? And the algorithm said you should hire white males because most of the people that had been previously hired were white males, which clearly is actually totally contrary to what is right ethically, and actually it's not even a good business decision because there's a shortage of tech skills, so we want to be totally inclusive and bring in the people who aren't included. So that one got turned off fairly quickly, but it's a really good point that, you know, how do we avoid bias in algorithms? Because, you know, if they're done well, these things can be really helpful. But if they're done badly, they're massively destructive. How do we avoid that bias?
Evaluate what you do. So there's, if you talk to data scientists about evaluation, they might say things like, oh, well, 89% accuracy of my machine learning model. That's not the kind of evaluation I'm talking about. I'm saying if you have a service that you're delivering at the moment, you then add on some form of data science. So for example, say you add on a bit of machine learning which says, oh, I think you should target extra early intervention to these individuals. Take in account your outcomes before you implemented that model. Look at your outcomes after you implemented that model and understand how people are doing. So the model's just an added thing. Look at how your service is performing for the people you're seeking to serve. And if suddenly actually there's a particular group that aren't doing as well as they used to do, why is that? Or actually as everyone who's coming through the door suddenly shifted demographic, why is that? So it's, I think, very much about understanding the impact that what you're creating has after you've implemented it. That would be one of my points. The second one is, if you kind of go back in time, while you're designing a system, look at what is affecting the outcomes of your model. So, for example, we working with one organisation, we found that the model was taking country of birth, and that was heavily influencing the outcome that the model was spitting out for people, dependent on their country of birth. Actually, we looked at that data. Firstly, it wasn't very good. Secondly, for some particular countries of birth, there wasn't that many people coming from those places, and they were heavily skewing the output that the model gave. So if we hadn't looked closer, then we wouldn't have been... We wouldn't be able to take that into account. So take in mind what your model's using. Also, what your data quality is. Like, rubbish in, rubbish out.
Yeah.
There's no way to get around that. Like, don't use poor quality data to do flashy things.
And how Giselle, do those same principles apply? Because I know, obviously, for lots of people like us that work in the sector, quite often we're creating digital products which are sort of hyper-local or hyper-focused on a particular community. So say, for example, if I'm creating an app that's for sex workers in Manchester, or I'm creating an app that's for Somali women in a particular area of London, and have I got enough data to make that the design of that product good, or is it just about looking at the outcomes and continuing to evolve and refine?
Have you got enough data to, I don't think
I
understand the question.
So technology for charities, we're quite often making hyper-local solutions. So something like The Mix, I've got 2.5 million young people coming through, and it's a national service, and it's all quite big, mm-hmm. and it's a bit more platformy. But actually a lot of the digital products that are created in even by large organisations focus on very tightly on small groups and or trying to affect a very particular problem. And it's one of the brilliant things we can do, because you can go, look, I'm really worried about access to this kind of care from this particular group, and I can drill right down on it. So do we have enough info to make a really balanced ethical product from those very tight groups? Or is, that's really my question.
It feels to me like there's two parts of that, and one is a design question and the other is a data question. And for the design, I'm sure you're doing the human-centric design stuff where you ask your users about it. For in terms of the data bit, can you evaluate outcomes at a high enough volume that you're understanding the impact of the way you're designing that particular app? Is that the question? Yeah. So it depends on the numbers. If they're very small numbers, then maybe you can't do it with a high level of confidence, but you can do it with enough anecdote to ensure that you are at that given moment, you are not having a negative effect on that group, and you keep an eye on it, and basically you keep that what I call anecdote, which is what qualitative researchers would call data, rightly. So data on individuals, you keep that coming in and ensure that you are always changing, always evaluating, always adapting on your whatever you're doing to those individuals. So don't see it as something static. When there's bigger numbers, you can, I think, take a bit of a snapshot at any given moment and say, okay, it's had this particular impact. We're going to come back in 3 months, or we're going to come back in 6 months.
So actually that ethical objective becomes almost even more important for the smaller interactions, because you're going to lean on, is this doing what we wanted it to do? Is it, are we not being evil?
So I'd say data science does not naturally lend itself to small data sets. So when you are doing something with what might be beautiful data that's very rich, but on a small amount of people, then usually you can't do fancy things.
Avast Antivirus Cloudcare has over 400 million active users in their network, who provide a continual stream of data that helps quickly identify and destroy any cyber threat and predict future ones. With Avast Business, charities get award-winning protection and a cloud-based management portal that enables an administrator to manage security from any device, all for the low price of £6 per user. Find out more at charitydigitalexchange.org.
So I'd like to move the conversation on a bit as well, because one of the other important aspects of digital ethics, I think, is ensuring that services are designed in ways that are truly inclusive. So if we're not careful in designing digital services, we might create a service that can't be used by a certain subsection of the population. The obvious will be, if I've got an online service, how does that service get provided for people who are blind, for example? Just as in the old days when everything was done by telephone, how's that service provided for people who are deaf? So I'm interested, maybe you've got a perspective on this, James. How can we ensure that we design services that are inclusive and therefore ethically sound in that way as well?
So I'm starting to become increasingly convinced that actually we need to start right at the beginning on a lot of this stuff. I've done a lot of website projects now, and I've also done a lot of print design projects, and I end up having to go back to designers to remind them about things, basic accessibility things that they don't know about. And I think it's because they're accustomed to trying to please the customers, and they want to make it look nice, and they don't necessarily think about what the colour contrast ratios are between certain colours, and the text won't be viewable, and all of these types of things. So I think that often you end up with a beautiful looking website, but it's very difficult for it to be accessible to certain people, and often that in turn has come from a print design. So the print designer has made the background orange and the text red when he's been doing the print design, and then that's been given to you to put online as part of the website. I think accessible design is really important. I'm increasingly convinced it should be also transferred into print, and I think what you do if you start to tailor your website, your apps, all of these things to be more inclusive, you actually end up with a much better website is the end result. And I think added to that, I think one of the things I've noticed a lot recently is the environmental impact of the web's having. So the internet's producing as much carbon every year as the airline industry, and I think a lot of people haven't quite cottoned on to this yet, but when they do, they're going to be pretty upset about it. So again, I think it comes back to our initial design and our way of thinking about how things are produced. So should we be having full width video across the entire homepage? I'm not sure we should have. Should we, with autoplay? I don't think that's such a great idea. I think we should be looking again to minimise all the size of the websites we're producing, make them as small and as energy efficient as possible, because sooner or later we want to run all our websites off solar panels, right? That's what we want to get to. So yeah, I think inclusivity around design, particularly as you're saying, looking at people with disabilities, is really important. I think again, our friends in the big tech companies have been very good in thinking about this in terms of voice assistants and things like that. What they've not been so good at doing is thinking about what the privacy implications of those voice assistants are. So we've ended up now with 100 million Amazon Alexa Stasi style bugging devices in people's houses that they've paid for the privilege of. Winston Smith in 1984 cowered in the corner so that he couldn't be seen by the view screen because it was monitoring him 24/7, whereas we've actually paid to put these devices into our houses to listen to us 24/7. There are alternative voice assistants to the ones the big tech companies have. So that's what I'd like to see people exploring, those alternative ones. There's a great one called Snips, which is open source, and you can download it onto your own device and do whatever you want with it. You can build skills for it, very similar to Amazon. Sonos, the speaker company, have just adopted Snips as their voice assistant of choice. So I would like to see in some of our bigger charities where we have innovation teams, I'd like to see them more targeted on that rather than adopting whatever big tech companies have come up with.
Chris, the mix obviously went online in the first place in order to ensure that it was getting to its core audience, younger people who prefer to interact online versus, you know, traditional channels. But within young people as a whole, I guess that, you know, there are lots of different segments, and therefore you probably need to consider accessibility as well. How has that played through in your services?
In a way, we're rather a cop-out because actually our mission is to support all young people to make informed choices so they can go and live better lives. So as a result, we've looked to support that by making sure our services are accessible, by making sure they're available in various multiple languages, by making sure they're multi-channel, so young people can choose actually how they interact with that service. We've got a multi-channel phone line, we've got a website, we've got a community, so the sort of individual preference of a young person or their need, their point of need, like how quickly they need to interact or what kind of conversation they need to have, can be supported. But we have sort of made some choices around what that level of support might actually involve. So for us, it's based around giving access to information, we think, and it's based around facilitating connections to ongoing support or experts or peers, and it's based around building covered positivity. So we've made some ethical decisions about what we think will facilitate that, and we've rendered that in a physical environment. I think probably the push for us is around those differences in segments in young people. Are we doing it as well as we could for particular individual groups? So whether that be gender, whether it be cultural, we know there are some young people of different cultural backgrounds who they have a different world around them, and may not be as relaxed with some of the content on the website, or they may want more support around family. We know we have a gender bias and we have more young women using our service. We have a lot of LGBTQI young people using our service. So there's lots of things which we can see in those people who use us, and maybe we should be tuning slightly better to ensure that actually are they really getting what they want out of our service. We can see them coming in, but yeah. can we really do it better? I think that the cultural thing is particularly interesting. For us, we have... we can see, for example, we have a lot of young people coming from Texas. We don't include them in our UK results, but actually they're coming from areas where there's less access to sexual health and relationships information. So we can see a genuine need there. So, but do we need to talk to them in a different way? Because they're in a society which is not allowing them to talk about that as well. So it's great we're giving them the content, the access, and allowing them to talk to other young people about it. But is there something else which they've got to mitigate? So it's brilliant. We have this wonderful big net and everybody comes in, but actually I think the next stage for us is looking at what do those segments really need from us? Because we'll just get better outcomes long term if we can serve them better.
Yeah.
And to add a point on, I agree with what you said, to add a point on accessibility, I think one thing to keep in mind is that there's no such thing as neutral when you're making tech or digital products. And I think we tend to think we're kind of starting from this kind of place of neutrality when we start building something, and that we can make it this way to go towards this group or this way to go towards that group. But actually our neutral tends to have inbuilt bias towards particular kind of what we perceive as default groups, which can be kind of white male for a lot of products. I'd recommend, if anyone's interested, to read Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. Talks wonderfully about this in particular in relation to gender. It's one of the books that we've discussed in our data ethics book club. Another great one on this topic is Race After Technology, which is Ruha Benjamin. And that's my two plugs for wonderful authors.
Yeah. Good. That's actually very timely, because that actually moved me on to, I guess, we've talked about a lot of areas. I want to focus back on practical steps that we can recommend for charities to get to grips to this. Because I guess one of the worries I have is an environment in which we want charities to embrace more the digital challenge and the opportunities that are there. You know, the stats show that still, you know, roughly half are not doing as much as they should. And digital ethics could become another reason to do less. You know, this is all a bit too hard, and let's just not get involved in it. So I'd like us to leave with some practical tips that charities can take. You've obviously recommended a couple of good sources there, but what other practical steps would we recommend that charities take to help them navigate the area of digital ethics?
Well, I think Giselle said it earlier, and I think she was spot on, which is the need to talk about this. I think there's precious little discussion, if any, going on at the moment that I can see anywhere. And yes, I think you're right. And one of the things we don't want to do is scare the already reluctant people away. That's true. But we do have a lot of organisations which are at that point in their maturity now of their development around digital, that they, you know, they should be talking about this, and they should be comfortable with it being uncomfortable about it. Therefore, I think the discussion is key. And I would like to see when all the big conferences come up, the charity comms one and all of the different ones, so far this year, there's been nothing about any of this area. And you know, if you look at all the other parts of society, even the private sector seems a long way ahead on this. So I think the key really is discussion, and I'd really like to see a lot of the very prominent fellow heads of digital who are a lot more prominent on social media, for example, than I am, talking about it, because they're not talking about it at all at the moment.
I think we shouldn't forget we've got a bit of a head start on the digital ethics thing. Charities are not created simply because we thought something was going to be cool. We were creative because there was a problem which we wanted to solve in society, and we've put a lot of time and effort and thought into how that problem should best be solved. So I think in our hearts, we've already got the answers to some of these ethical questions. So I would encourage charities to look at, when they build their digital tools, build them just to fix the problems which they were trying to fix in the real world. And when you feel yourself getting too techie and going, wouldn't it be awesome if we did this in a platform because we can, if it feels wrong, it probably is wrong, don't do it. We've got lots of really talented, brilliant digital people coming into our sector. We're very lucky to have them coming in who want to do more with their social thing. If you're a practitioner, don't be bullied by them. Work with them closely. Give them the information they need to design these tools, because actually we know more about what we need to do in an ethical way than we give ourselves credit for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'd echo both of those points. Just building on that, Chris's kind of creepy factor. Like, if it feels wrong, it probably is. I'd agree with that. But add on the fact that we need to make sure that there are a mix of people in the room to feel that and voice that, and make sure that that's reflective of our users as well. I feel perhaps in this conversation we have been a bit down on data and digital, because we've been talking about kind of the worries rather than the hopes for it. So I do want to just stick in a positive moment, which is that data science can do a lot to transform the impact of the services that all of us are trying to ensure vulnerable people can access. So let's not forget that there's a potential win here. Mm. And the flip side of that is that there is a cost of inactivity. So I would warn against kind of feeling scared and therefore doing nothing.
Yeah.
Because that's probably going to have a negative impact on the people you're trying to get to. There's probably a lot of people in your organisations working very hard to serve the groups you're seeking to serve. If you're not making use of the data that you're producing via those services, then you're not working as effectively to ensure good outcomes for those individuals. So do make use of data science. But going back to Chris's point, figure out the why first and start from there. And going to James's point, talk about it, ask for help. Don't worry that you might be having conversations which you feel are kind of foundational. That's okay. It's a great place to start. Mm. We all have to do this. And the reason why some of the big companies aren't necessarily having these conversations in the open is not because they necessarily know better. It's because they don't want to have these conversations in the open. Let's not learn secrecy from them. Let's do it a different way. And then probably the last note I'd have is to talk about data, even if you're not thinking primarily about data. So if you're thinking about digital and tech and you're making those products, data is going to flow out of them, probably also into them. It is inevitable. So consider that. Think to James' point about minimization and what you want to keep. Think about how you might want to use it. Think about why you're using it in that way and why you're collecting it. So don't, yeah, the data and digital are kind of a flip sides of the same coin.
Could I add something as well? Very aspirational and positive, don't worry.
Go for it.
Just picking up really on something Chris was saying about what we do in the charity sector, and basically we pick up the problems that no one else wants to pick up or have failed to deal with, and that be the private sector or the government in many cases. And one thing I hear a lot is, I want my charity to be like Monzo, or I want it to be out Amazon, or these types of things. And I think we really need to develop our own sort of digital culture where it's actually one that we create ourselves. It's not about trying to be like someone else, especially not a corporate organisation, because, you know, they've got some traits, and as we've discussed, they've got some ideas and values which don't meet ours. I think it's about all the great movements around creating something new and amazing have all come from a rejection of what's around you, and trying to think from a blank piece of paper. They haven't come from trying to be like something else. So I think we should be looking at the fact that we pick up those problems that other people have failed with, but also that we've got organisations that have been working for decades and in some cases centuries, and they've been doing things like curing disease and fighting poverty and doing some absolutely unbelievable things which have made a real difference to the human race. You know, this isn't like clicking on a link or, you know, getting more people to look at an ad. This is like pretty serious stuff.
We've probably been using data all along.
They have been, yeah. But I mean, I think we should be looking at ourselves for our role models and the people we look up to, because quite often they're sitting on the desk next to you, and it's not Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos. It's someone like that who's probably worked in that charity for 20 years and has done some amazing stuff, and they're the people that we should be looking up to.
Good. Well, thank you for that discussion. We've covered a lot of ground. I think we've illustrated that some of these discussions are a bit uncomfortable, but it's right, I think, that we need to bring them out into the open and have them. And for that reason, we've been covering more on this theme within Charity Digital News. So we have got a number of past articles which talk about some of the resources people might want to use. I think one other resource I'd point people to, the Charity Digital Code, which covers a lot of areas. It has a section on digital ethics as well. It's a nice short section, so it's very easy to use as well, so people could access that. But I think that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to wrap up by thanking very much our speakers, Giselle, Chris and James. Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.